This podcast of The Treatment is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support this free service by September 5th, and you could win a Mini Cooper S convertible. Go to KCRW.com for details.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest, writer, director, actor, Paul Feig, has explored his angst-filled teen years in the show Freaks and Geeks, which he created, but also in his incredibly funny new memoir, the book Superstud, with an incredibly revealing photograph on the cover. Paul, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Elvis.
We both grew up in southeastern Michigan in what they call the Tri-County area, the Metro Detroit area. Yet your experience was probably somewhat different from mine, sort of manifest by the fact that you remained a virgin throughout your entire high school career.
Exactly. I didn't set out to be that way. It was a healthy dose of fear of sex and fear of exposing oneself.
And fear of God.
Well, exactly. A big dose of that. It's amazing how that will affect one's life.
A lot of doses there in your life, but not the kind of dose you get from sex, but from abstaining.
Exactly.
From sex. I'm curious because the book is so funny about that. And in reading it, I just kind of wonder at what point you decided you want to write the book, if there's a specific chapter that came to you first. If you start to write in chronological order.
Yeah, what happens with a lot of these, because I in my previous book, Kick Me, also that kind of came from 15 years ago. I started writing these funny, quote-unquote, stories from being in school. That was the motivation was I had won $29,000 on the $25,000 pyramid when I was 24 years old. That's a lot of 20s I just threw out there. And because of that, I got to get two things I always wanted, which was a new television and a typewriter, an IBM typewriter. So when I got the typewriter, I was like, I don't know what to write. So I'll write funny stories from my childhood and started writing these ridiculous stories from school and then gave a bunch of them to my dad. And he said, well, who wants to read about stories? Who wants to read about you in school? And I was like, I guess you're right. And so I put them away. And then once Freaks and Geeks actually, you know, a few people watched it and liked it. I was like, well, let me pull out these stories because a lot of the stories were based on things that actually happened to me. Like the dodgeball story was actually right out of my past. And so then the book kind of came together that way. And then, you know, the stories in Superstud are other stories that had either I've been telling for a while or else had wanted to explore again, and a couple in there that I had no idea I was going to write and completely horrified my wife by writing them.
You talked about sort of having written these stories before. Had you sort of practiced the form that you wanted the book to come out in as you were telling these stories? Did the book kind of coalesce for you at some point in those ways?
It's funny. I'd always found – I started out as a stand-up comedian back when I was 15 years old and started in Detroit doing it and then moved out here and was doing it. And I had begun doing like characters. I had a character of like a woodshop teacher who tells jokes. And so I would kind of hide behind these characters. But people were always like, well, those are funny, but, you know, we don't know who you are. We'd like to know more about you. At the same time, whenever I would hang out with people, I would tell these ridiculous stories of my childhood just in, you know, as people tell stories about their sexual past or their humiliating past. I would always, you know, not try to top them but always seem to end up topping people because is Judd Apatow, who produced Freaks and Geeks with me, he said everybody has a terrible story to tell and then you tell yours and it's like 10 times worse than everybody else's. So just from that, I would find that people would always enjoy them so much that I thought, well, let's try writing them out. And so I write them in a very, very conversational tone.
My guess is Paul Feig, his book is Superstud, which he is obviously, Natalie attired in suit here at KCRW. I'm asking this because I'm wondering if there's a specific story that maybe grew out of a stand-up or that you had like written and kind of refined. You thought, this is, I'm going to start with this. Because I wondered the story in which you find the photograph. If you talk about that whole incident,
well,
that seemed to me like a good starting off point. And I wonder if that's how the book started for you.
In a weird way, it did, yeah, because Well, it started out with digging around in my parents' closet and coming across this party hat that my dad had from the 1950s that was this kind of bowler derby wrapped in cellophane that had this picture of a topless woman in it on it. And she was very airbrushed and looked like more like a, kind of like a drawing from the World War II or something. But for a 12-year-old with a burgeoning libido, it was like finding, you know, the Holy Grail. And so I dated that hat for quite a while, and then from there, kind of, you know, my mom had all these fashion magazines around, and so I would kind of discover these pictures.
Was it W you said it was?
Yeah, W was the one that was my downfall, because it was like this large format. It was the size of like the New York Times or whatever, and it was sitting on this but we had like this hamper across from the toilet that was kind of this ersatz coffee table we had in the bathroom, and there would always be kind of these fashion magazines piled up. And so one day I was looking, flipping through it, and like I turned the page and I thought, it felt like somebody punched me in the face, because there, like, this 2.5-foot tall picture of a completely naked girl. Like from the waist up, but she was topless, standing in the middle of this field, and it was for a skin product that was to let us know, you know, let women know, look how beautiful and soft your skin can be. And, you know, while that might work for them, for me it was just like, oh my God, I found religion here. And it just, you know, so that started this whole thing of like, oh my God, there's publications that aren't Playboy that have all these pictures of these kind of naked women in them. And so then the place where I became my mecca was the photography section at the local bookstore, because you discover, oh, look, there's pictures of naked models in these otherwise very dry looking books about photography. And so I cracked the code.
My guest cracked the code is Paul Feig. His book is super stud. And what's funny about all these chapters is with these incidents, like as you spent more and more time with the woman from the hat, she came to seem much tawdrier to you. Her charm seemed to disappear after each encounter. It was almost like a real relationship. You got tired of her.
It's exactly. We didn't have the benefit of conversation to see if we if we actually hit it off and had things we could talk about. So she was kind of my trophy wife, but her charms wore off. It was true.
And then the girls from W just fled one day because they were put out with the trash.
Yes. Oh, yeah. That was a relationship that was cut short. It was tragically cut short, because I only got to spend literally one afternoon with my
high fashion model.
Exactly. My gal. And then I came home from school the next day and discovered she had been put out the trash, and the trash had come, and she was ground up with old diapers and orange rinds in the garbage. So,
which sent you on your lonely walk to the mall to the photo section.
Exactly. Where I discovered the photography section. Exactly. And then the problem with the photography section is, you know, if you're somebody who's brave enough to be able to get Playboys or to actually walk in and buy them, you save a lot of money, because when you're getting your low-rent pornography at the photography section, all the books cost, you know, $20, $30 a piece. I had an interesting thing happen, though. There was one book that I found that I had an especially long relationship with, which was the words poems of Bernie Taupin with pictures by some guy, and it was all these naked pictures of this beautiful woman. So of course I had the benefit of, I was a huge Elton John fan, so it was like the perfect cover, because like if anybody found it, it's like, what are you talking about? I don't know those pictures. Like, I just like Bernie Taupin's lyrics, you know. They just happen to have this lady in there. So cut to about 10 years later, I move out to California, and I'm taking this improv class, and I'm auditing it before I actually start it, because you can sit in the back. So I'm sitting in the back one day watching this class, and I turn, and there is the woman who was the model in that book sitting like 2 chairs away from me.
Was she in the model for all the songs? Each song didn't have a different girl?
No, it was all just her in different naked poses.
And what did you say to her?
I said nothing. I thought I was going to have a heart attack. It was literally like, I can't even tell you what it was literally like. It was just like seeing this vision. And the problem was going like, she knows what I've done. She can see it on my face. Her eyes had stared out at me for so long from the pages of this book. How could she not know me and see into my soul? So I literally sat there with my heart pounding out of my chest and just waited for the class to be over. And she left, and I never said anything to her, and I never saw her again.
So I'm sure that brought new clarity to the title, Someone Saved My Life Tonight. My guest is Paul Feig. We're talking about his hilarious book. His new book, it's called Super Stud, dealing with his years of virginity. Many of them, quite a few, in alarmingly funny
detail. Stacked up like cordwood.
and just about as flammable too in so many cases, as combustible.
Exactly.
What your the way your sense of morality would just attack you when the possibility of sex would, if you pardon expression, expose itself. What's it like looking back on that now? The way how you get incredibly moral is that the possibility of sex really was apparent.
Well, it was weird. It became such a – it went in these stages because at first I was this Sunday school going kid who was very moralistic, and I kind of then took the interpretation of my religion, which was I grew up as a Christian Scientist, and their whole thing is to look away from the body, look away from the physical. So that then translates into you're not supposed to give any power to sex. But then I took and started compounding that by things I was seeing. There was a pamphlet that they always had on the table at my Sunday school said chastity, the premarital standard. So it was like, this kind of these words would come in and think, yes, they're right. Then at the same time, there's the fear of it. Just the idea, I was terrified to get undressed in gym class in the locker room in front of, my friends. So then compound that with now I'm going to get undressed, in front of a girl or whatever. And I would hear stories of friends going to the prom, and then they were one of my friends was like, yeah, I had her prom dress off, up over her head in the car afterwards. I'm like, oh, my God. I just couldn't get over the fact that you who I'm talking to, actually you had sex with a girl and how does that work? And I just couldn't I was so naive and so terrified of it that then you use that as kind of this weapon of and I'm not going to do that. You become more moral to protect yourself. And but at the same time, you're still being drawn to it. And, and I had kind of discovered the onanastic activity earlier than all my peers. So in a way, I was venting it that way. But so it was this weird combo of kind of having this kind of raging libido and yet trying to cover it up and trying to excuse yourself from the activities that other people were doing. And on top of this, it was at the end of the 70s. So it wasn't like now where there's a lot more, look, the specter of AIDS changed everything. That's why I wanted to – one of the reasons I set Freaks and Geeks in the late 70s because I wanted kids dealing with that kind of fear of sex for real. Not like, oh, I'm going to die if I do this, but what are the ramifications of this? How does my teenage psyche deal with this ultimate exposing of oneself, which is, to have sex with somebody, you're exposing everything. So, literally mentally and physically. So it's a weird thing. And just as you get old, as I got into my 20s, it just became this drumbeat. But here's the thing was it also the longer you hold in your virginity, the more it becomes this possession that it's almost like this title you don't want to give up. It was for me. So it was like, when I actually was kind of bargaining with myself and I had this girlfriend who looked like would actually have sex with me, I was going to give up my virginity, it was much more of a thing. The moralism of what is God going to do to me, kind of was dissipating a little bit because as you get older and I was much more into science, so I was really going away from my religion and all that. But the last vestige of this was I have this title of I am a virgin. Am I willing to get up in the morning after I do this and to say, I am no longer virgin. I no longer have this thing that sometimes can make me feel morally above people I didn't like. Like all the frat guys that were at the colleges when I was there and all kind of the jerks who were on television and TV who were always making passes at women and making them cry. And, the cheesy disco guys I used to see at the teen disco, I'd go to have their shirts unbuttoned down to their navels. Did I want to equate myself with those guys who their whole goal was to have sex with women? But I couldn't find that ground of oh, no, I'm doing it because I love this person as opposed to I'm just catting around every night. So, but once you gave it up, it was a shock. But then you go, okay, but now I've gained something else.
We'll find out what that is after this break. My guest is Paul Feig. His amazing, funny book is Super Stud. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. Shake it,
don't break it. You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. I'm talking to Paul Feig, the creator of Freaks and Geeks and the author of the book Super Stud, which strikes me as a kind of a combination of sort of Dan Wakefield and Woody Allen, a kind of intersection of those. And I wonder if those guys are influences on the way you sort of look back in your adolescence at all.
Yeah. I love anybody who can take their personal experiences and kind of string them out in a way that is very personal and yet other people can relate to. It's funny. I had never read David Sedaris until after we had done Freaks and Geeks, and one of our cast members had given me the book Naked. And I read it and was just like, oh, my God, this is so great. And that's what made me think, like, I should pull out those old stories. I like people who expose their innermost fears and secrets because at times in my life I've had – read that stuff or seen it or seen comedians who do that. And it's really helped me to realize, oh, I'm not the only freak. I'm not the only one who did that. That's why to me it's the greatest moment when somebody who's either read my book or watches Freaks and Geeks, especially like, you know, somebody in their teens will come up and go, oh, I'm so glad to see that because, you know, I always thought it was just me who did that or I did that same thing. So that to me is the reward. If you can actually touch somebody and make them realize that they're not the only one who had these weird experiences. The only danger is you write something and you go, everybody did this. And then they come up and they go like, that's the weirdest thing I ever read. I never did that before. What's wrong with you, you freak? And then you're like, okay, well, I guess it was just me. But now I know.
Well, it's weird because it's impossible for me to sit here watching the microphone and not think about that thing you did. In that movie.
Oh, my gosh. See, I thought you were talking about that chapter, which is that other thing I did.
Yes, we'll get to that in a second.
But really? My career as an actor, yes, that follows me around like a piece of toilet paper stuck on your heel. I was Mr. Poole on Sabrina the Teenage Witch, and I still receive the occasional email from a fan is too strong of a word. It's usually somebody looking to get the address of Melissa Joan Hart. Hey, you were on that show. Do you know that girl? I was like, oh, no. It's hard getting compliments when you're on TV. I did all the TV commercials for my dad's store. That was my beginnings as a writer, director, producer. I did these horrible commercials for Channel 50 in Detroit. And, you know, I would wear stupid outfits. I played Groucho once. I was Tarzan. It was so dumb. You know, and I kind of kept waiting. I'm going to be famous. Everybody's going to know me. Nobody ever kind of recognized me. But then one day this guy came into the store, a customer, and I, you know, was working at my dad's store. Can I help you? He goes, hey, you're the guy on the TV commercials, aren't you? I said, yes, I am. Thank you very much. He said, hey, I didn't say I liked them. I meet the public for the first time. And he was right.
Well, let's talk about that thing you did in the book. So we were talking before we started here. And I just kind of wonder how you showed chapters, certain chapters to your wife. Let's start with Don't Read This Chapter.
Yes, exactly. There's a chapter towards the end of the book called Please Don't Read This Chapter, which is about an experiment, let's say, that I tried way back in my early 20s when things weren't going great. And yet one is this will be a test of how delicate I can speak on the radio.
I'm sitting here with my grading pad. Go ahead.
Oh, my. you know, one has urges and things that one hears about that or sees pictures of or sees in movies that one says, well, that'd be great if somebody did that to me. You know, if a member of the opposite sex would show up and you know, indulge. And so since that was not a forthcoming event and there was no additional personnel around to make this happen, I thought, well, perhaps I could make it happen by myself. The only thing in one's way is the curvature of one's spine and the working of one's vertebrae. See, it's getting bad. And almost broke my neck and my back trying it. But I did give it the college try. And fortunate for me, it didn't happen because, as the old joke says, you'd never leave the house. And so there you go.
In case you've forgotten what it is you're listening to, it's The Treatment. My guest is Paul Feig. We're talking about his book, Super Stud. You were talking about the way that chapter got written. You were on vacation and then
and I woke up one morning as I was writing this book and said, oh, I should tell that story. And then when I can't, I went through all these things of like, I can't. And then said, well, let me just see. So I literally sit on this table on this hotel we're at and start writing this absolutely horrendous story of trying to please oneself. And I just knew, my wife knew that's what I was writing on vacation. She would absolutely kill me. And, you know, I didn't even want her to read it. But then, you know, once we got back and months later when I had most of the book finished, I was like, well, let me pass some chapters by her. And so she sits down and she starts reading, you know, chapters that are slightly more embarrassing and then, you know, kind of reacting occasionally, a little chuckle here and there. And then I kind of looking over, you know, as I'm pretending to read the paper, I see that she's looking at this, getting to that chapter. I'm like, well, what's going on? And it's kind of silence and the pages are turning. You know? If I was doing the sound for it, I would have put a grandfather clock in ticking very quietly in the background. And then she kind of finished it and just put it down and said, you're not going to print that story, are you? It's like, I probably will. I think it's funny. And she's like, it's not funny. Don't print that story. And the whole run up to the book, she's like, you're going to cut that chapter out, right? And it's like, well, I'm thinking about it. I don't know. You know. And the editor went through all and we cut other chapters and that one just kind of stayed. Here's how I got burned by my editor, who I love very much. But I sent that chapter to her saying like, okay, I'm really worried about this chapter. Tell me if this is just completely crazy. And you're a woman, so you can give me the perspective of it's just going to be nuts. And she, oh, no, it's fine. It's hilarious. I love it. Okay, good. Well, don't tell anybody about this. A couple months later, I go, I don't know. My wife thinks I should cut that chapter out. She goes, well, you can't because I already sent it out to all the booksellers. She sent it out as a sample chapter to the booksellers. So then I had to go to my wife. Well, I would – so that, it gave me the good excuse. So it was kind of like going like, I want to cut it out, but it's already out there. Yeah. So she goes, great. Now I can never go into a bookstore again. Well, wear a mask.
What's kind of impressive in the book is the constant sort of delineation of your sense of fastidiousness. I mean, there's this sort of vanity of yours that sort of has to sort of alternate with this – beast trying to claw its way out of your bloodstream.
Well, yeah, I was always a very neat kid. I always liked dressing in a certain way and keeping things, you know. I was also very germophobic, completely crazy about germs. I mean, once I made a big scene in a restaurant when I was like 7 because I had my orange juice. My dad reached over and took a drink out of it. I was like, no, like screamed so loud. And like all these older guys staring over like, you know, take that kid out back and horsewhip him or something. So, but I couldn't help it. I was just completely terrified. So that didn't help with the fear of sex at all, was the idea that, you know, if there was ever a germ swapping event of greater magnitude, it would be the sexual act. So, and then, you know, I even just getting my head around the French kissing thing. Look, I was always a slow learner. I was, as my parents were always happy to tell me, my father's particularly was, you know, you were the last one to learn how to walk, and then I was the last one to learn how to ride a bike, and I was kind of the last one to learn everything, apparently. And so it only makes sense that I would lose my virginity about 5 to 7 years after everybody else did.
But that neatness, that tidiness is just – what I like about the book is that it's just kind of there as an element. You don't make a big deal out of it.
Yeah. What we're all stuck with in life is who we are and what we bring along with us. And my feeling is always you can't – if you're trying to figure out why you do stuff or looking at the overview of what you've done, you can't separate out different parts of your life. Just like I can't – you know, at one point I think the publisher was kind of like, hey, you really want to put that religion stuff in there? And it's like I can't take that out because that affected my problems with and fear of sex as much as anything else in my life did. So if I want to do an honest assessment of this, you have to talk about, you know, your fear of religion or what or of God or whatever. And at the same and also you have to allude to the fact that look, I had these germaphobe problems and I was very neat and I, you know, hence being neat physically meant I wanted to keep my life neat and I wanted things to be very orderly. And so like that's why I always had trouble breaking up with girls because it introduced such disorder to your life. Here's the thing. In order to be the catting around guy, and I knew so many guys who were always on the make and they would, you know, do it all the time and stuff I'd see in movies. In order to do that, it wasn't like, you know, you find a willing partner and like, okay, we're just going to have one night stand. Yes, sir. We'll have one night stand and then it ends. Thank you very much. That was a wonderful act, you know, short of paying somebody. So what would have to happen in order to be the catting around guys, you would have to introduce such disorder into your life, which is, all right, baby, hey, can't call you back anymore. Good seeing you. You know, I'll call you sometime. Where are you going? You know, that. And to me, that was just like the most abhorrent thing in the world of like somebody's going to hate me and then I'm going to be this guy who was – you know, in the Wild Bunch, one of my favorite movies, when he, you know, William Holden kind of flips the coin at the gal and, you know, at the hooker. And it's like, I was like, oh, how can you, you just had sex with her and now you're just, you're mean. And it's like, that doesn't make, it blows my mind. You should marry her. That was always my concept, is the minute you have sex with somebody, you got to marry them like the very next moment. You know, because to me, it was just like out of gratitude. Of like, thank you for letting my acneed face come so near your face.
It's the treatment. We're talking to Paul Feig, not about the Wild Bunch, and a whole aspect of that movie that had never occurred to me in the many times I've seen it over the years. His book is super stud. And you reminded me of another aspect of the book, another avenue, in that as soon as you developed a wild crush on a girl, you were already fantasizing the wedding ceremony.
Oh, my gosh, yes. Because I was – look, I always was a hopeless romantic and still am. Look, part of it, as I've just admitted, was the idea of like, well – you know, you find somebody that you really like, a girl you really like, and, you know, your mind immediately, it hits you in the libido as much as it hits you anywhere else, because she's pretty or she's your type or this or that. So the minute those thoughts that are, you know, what I would have called back then unpure came about, is like, well, then, okay, if I'm angling that way at all, then I have to want to convince myself that I want to marry her. So that was – so – and then on top of it, just being a romantic type, I grew up with such this 1940s view of the world, you know, this Mickey Rooney-ish kind of, you find somebody, you fall in love, and you marry them. I didn't agree with the, and then you divorce them and just kind of have this string of divorces behind you. But it felt like that to me felt like that had to be the goal of human relations, to date just to kind of have fun. It didn't compute for me, because if you're going to go on a date, well, why are you doing that other than you're auditioning wives, basically? And so that's why the catting around thing didn't compute for me, because, like, no, you're clearly going to test these people out. And the only thing I could see was, well, maybe if you sleep with somebody you realize you don't get along sexually. But that didn't even kind of compute for me, because I couldn't imagine sex being bad once you had it. Like, I would always hear things, oh, that was the worst sex I ever had, like on TV or these things. I'm like, how could it – just the fact that you were there and somebody allowed you to do that.
Well, that's kind of fun and touching about the book too, is that as soon as you get the note, the girl's like, oh, wait a second. I'm not in love with her.
It was a shocker. I mean, to be honest, I mean, the final chapter of the book is when I actually lose my virginity, and it was such an epic event for me. But it was also an epic event of kind of this crash course in what life is all about, which is like, oh, okay, this can be not what you think it's going to be, or this can be unsatisfying. I mean, in all fairness to the girl, it was unsatisfying partly because I had no idea what I was doing. You know, I literally didn't know the dynamics of it. All I kind of had were my little sad little pictures from fashion magazines, and then a few Playboys that I had amassed over the year that didn't prepare me for anything as far as the female anatomy goes, because, you know, I just couldn't. Things weren't where I thought they were supposed to be.
If only there were a camera here to show where your hands are flying right now.
I'm making diagrams right now. So it was just kind of this ridiculous fumbling around. And then I was so afraid she was going to stop the act that I had to go to the bathroom horribly. I had drank, you know, a full pitcher of iced tea. And, you know, it was like, if I leave the room, she's going to say no. And I've made the decision. I'm going forward with this. So I'm going to. So it was my fault that it didn't go well.
Well, I've got to thank you for doing this, Paul. My guest is Paul Feig. His new book is super stud.
Elvis, I'm such a huge fan of the show. It's been an absolute pleasure.
This hilarious book is super stud. Please go out and pick it up. Our technical director is Mario Diaz. Bob Carlson is the editor. Mary Holdridge produces the program. I have no idea how this is going to air. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
Good luck.
An audio archive of this and other programs can be found at kcrw.com. For questions and comments about The Treatment, please email us at thetreatment@kcrw.com. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.